We've come to the San Fernando Valley, which is now home for an old Chicago friend by the name of Hugh Studebaker, who made a very important name for himself in the good old days of radio, and who made some very important contributions to the so-called good old days of radio. How you doing, Mr. Studebaker?
Well, I'm doing fine. I don't know quite why you stress that old so much. I'll forgive you for that.
Okay, though. I'm sorry. Well, they were good days at any rate.
I'm talking about your initial sentence. The radio was good old, and I wish them back.
Yeah, it would be nice to have them back. You played an important part, as I said, in the radio days. One of your major contributions, to name just the first that comes to mind, is on the Fibber McGee and Molly show before it left Chicago.
That's right.
In those days, you were known as a man on that show by the name of Silly Watson.
Silly Watson, yes.
Now, who was Silly Watson?
Silly Watson was the man of all work around Fibber's place, and he would never do now, which is the reason I didn't come to Hollywood with the show. It was the handwriting was very much on the wall that Negro characters played by white were out,
mm-hmm.
or going to be soon. And so I decided to stay where I was.
Uh-huh. Well, they left in 39, I think.
They left in 39. I was out here with them in 38. I came out on vacation for a couple of shows. That was my first introduction to Hollywood. And enjoyed it moderately. But I was glad to see them back in Chicago. Wishing he had stayed.
Uh-huh.
I was very fond of Jim and Marianne.
Silly Watson was a good character on the show, though, and really well-received by radio listeners.
Seemed to have been.
Oh, sure. How long did you play that character?
I imagine after about 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
It was after there was an early period in Fibber. I doubt even if Jim Jordan himself remembers how they got to 79 Wistful Vista. I was playing character parts about town and got called to come over to NBC and do this part on a new show. Fibber was driving his old equivalent of Benny's Maxwell. I forget what make it was, but it always came to a screeching halt, and Fibber's line then was, got to get them brakes fixed.
Oh.
Which at that time was almost equivalent to the door opening in the closet.
Mm-hmm.
But they came to this wide place in the road with signs up saying Wistful Vista, and there was an auctioneer auctioning off lots, and you could buy a chance on a lot for a small amount of money, which was very important to Fibber. So he bought a small amount of chances, and darn if he didn't win.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how 79 Wistful Vista came into being.
He won it.
He won it.
Only Fibber could do that.
Only Fibber could do that.
And Don Quinn, of course, the writer who
God
put it all together.
God rest him. Yeah. He's a wonderful man. We had a great crew on there. I always remember with great affection, all of them. Bill Thompson, Ted Weems, and Marilyn Maxwell, Perry Como. All of them very, very dear to my heart.
They were all a good part of that show. And, of course, you were, too. Did you play anything else on the McGee series besides Silly Watson?
Not consistently.
Mm-hmm.
Rather funny thing, shortly after I started playing on it in various parts, they called for an old man. And I played this old goat. And it was rather a good part. so it was so good that there was a man named Cliff Arquette in town who was rather good at that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So they called Cliff to do the part, which was perfectly proper. And Cliff did the part until he was called to Hollywood, and then Bill Thompson took it over, mm-hmm. very successfully, the old-timer. And so it went. One thing led to another.
Quite a great series, and I know you made a good contribution to it. You were very much involved in radio in those days. Those were the mid to late 30s. When did you start your radio career?
I started in 1927. I came off the road, off of a Chautauqua circuit, and Chautauqua was dying, and I had no place to go. I was stranded in Omaha, and I was studying or self-teaching organ. I formed a little compact with a big Methodist church there. They would give me a key to the church and to the organ if I would sing in the choir. So I was glad to make such a deal. And while I was waiting, I was called over to Council Bluffs by Harold Fair, one of the famous old monomotor twins who was very well known at that time, KOIL in Council Bluffs. And I did a little singing act for him. And the next week I was called to do a partnership act with a chap, Harold Fair. And we formed the Georgie and Porgy breakfast food team, selling a very noxious substance called Georgie Porgy breakfast food. Awful. And we made a circuit of the towns roundabout, out of York, Nebraska, where they also sold Chickavita and Hogavita. Maybe that's where the famous York hams got their mm-hmm. big start, I don't know. And farmers would come in, and we'd give them Georgie Porgy breakfast food, and they'd bring in cream, and so we saved money on that. And then we played Lincoln and Omaha, the grain exchange, and back over to KOIL, and Clarinda, Iowa, and various towns, Sioux City, Sioux Falls, and then that gave out, and I drifted back home to Mother, Kansas City, mm-hmm. and went to see Dick Smith at KMBC and did my same little singing act to him. And he put me on. That was in 1928. He put me on once a week, the Wednesday afternoon, 4:45. I'll always remember it. $2.50. Station took 25 cents of that for commission.
Well, they did.
Oh, yes.
The NBC Artist Bureau, huh?
No, that was the pre-Columbian period. And so that went on until football season, and Dick was called to do the KU football games, and he cornered me and said, "You'll do the announcing while I'm gone," and that... That set me to shaking like a proverbial leaf. Mm-hmm. But he said, "No, you can do it. You can do it. All you have to do is, when you get the cue, say, 'This is KMBC atop the Pickwick Hotel, Kansas City.'" So I very carefully wrote that down, so I got great at memorizing my lines. And so I got through that very nicely at... And I paid $1 an hour, a dollar an hour, and man, that was great money. And then things started to evolve.
Did you ever work with the Coon Sanders and the Nighthawks?
I worked with Joe Sanders before he met Cooney, I worked with him in a quartet.
You did?
Uh-huh. We performed at the old Newman Theater in Kansas City. And he was a wonderful man.
Did you bounce to Chicago shortly thereafter then?
No, I was in Kansas City for 4 years. Uh-huh. That's where I met Chickie, my wife, and whom I afterwards had the smart to marry.
And you're still married?
And still married. God
She's a lovely person, too.
Very, very happily. Kansas City was really more fun than any part of radio that I've ever done.
It was pretty loose, wasn't it, in those days?
Oh, anyone could do anything, you know. For instance, I'll give you a little... For instance, I once played Cyrano. I did Cyrano in French. I had never studied French. I didn't know any French, but I knew a fine French teacher. And we took about 3 weeks, and he taught me phonetically the part of Cyrano. The rest of the cast did theirs in English, and heaven knows what it must have sounded like. But we had a good orchestra back of us, those things, experiment of any kind, went in those days. And I started playing organ for Ted Malone, who did a very famous show called Between the Bookends. Mm-hmm. We started out as the Midnight Muse. At midnight in the old Plaza Theater movie house in Kansas City Plaza, and then moved the show to afternoon. And he also originated one of the original, I suppose I must call them soap operas, although I hate the term, and called Happy Hollow.
Mm-hmm.
In which I played the deep, dark villain. And Chickie played Annie Laurie, sweet little innocent ingenue, with whom I had no ill intentions. My intentions were perfectly honorable. But everybody on the show was connected with Happy Hollow in some way. Then I had a Pickwick travelogue, Pickwick Greyhound. They gave me seven prepared travelogues. It was on once a week. Mm-hmm. So I did them 15 minutes. When I ran out of that seven, I either repeated them or wrote new ones, got a map and made up my own, and I didn't know whether Greyhound ran to those towns or not, but I made up a tour. And as I say, you could do anything.
Well, it was nice because you were making a living out of radio.
Oh yes,
and that was something nice to be able to do in the late 20s. Really the beginning,
particularly in the early 30s, it came in handy.
Mm-hmm.
Because Happy Hollow started getting calls from surrounding towns. They would take an evening and buy tickets, ask for their artists of their choice, and we would go out and put on a show for them and split the profits, split the take, and that amounted to quite a lot. And golly, I never will forget the first week I made $100. That was big money in 1932. And, another show that I forgot was Easy Aces, Goodman Ace, whom, of course, you know.
Mm-hmm.
was a movie. Was a movie editor on the Kansas City Journal Post and a very, very fine critic. And he conceived the idea of Easy Aces. And he and his wife, Jane, and Dick Smith, and a girl by the name of Virginia Kramer, who was my opposite number in Happy Hollow, she was the villainess. And I did the announcing on Easy Aces.
Oh, you did? And
there's a interesting little tale to that dog. I decided to go up to Chicago one time and pay a visit. One of our great heroes, heroines, were Merton Marge at that time. Great show and very, very popular out of the Wrigley Building.
Mm-hmm.
And so I dropped in on them, and they were very, very gracious to me. Took me out for a drink and dinner and show. I went up to the Drake where WGN was and saw Easy Aces. And Truman Bradley was the announcer at that time. And he said, How would you like a night off, Truman? He said, fine. So I announced Easy Aces for the first. That was my first network experience.
Ah.
Yeah, felt quite important.
Gave Truman Bradley the night off, and you went to work.
I went
to work.
While
you were in town on a visit.
Yeah. It was quite a kick.
Well, now, is there a great ending to that yet? Did someone from the network hear you and say, we've got to have that man?
And unfortunately, no. No, I didn't. Nobody was waiting at the gate when Nellie came home. But I went back to Kansas City along with these appearances with Happy Hollow. The station had what they called a lot of due bills. And money being hard to come by, they'd advertise and get a due bill. Well, anybody who wanted to use a due bill could do it, which counted for my trip to Chicago because I got very, very good quarters in the Blackstone.
A due bill is such a thing where a hotel in one city, for example, would get advertising on a station in another town. To promote visitors to come to that hotel, and then instead of paying for the commercial, they would give this local station accommodation whenever they want. Take it out and trade, more or less.
And then along about that time, I believe I got... No, that was after I got to Chicago. United Airlines. I believe I was their first announcer. I did a series for them. Yes, that was after I got to Chicago. It was in 1933 that I decided to make the big break. I saw that I wasn't going to get any place eventually at KMBC, much as I loved it, much as I loved Kansas City. So I had a ring, which I was providentially able to hawk, and for enough to get me to Chicago. It was coming, looking back on it, at the height of the Depression, it was rather a nervy thing to do. I don't know how I managed it, but I guess I just didn't know any better. Nothing bad happens to you at that age, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I climbed on the train and went to Chicago. Got myself an $8 a week room. I didn't know where to start, but I started making the rounds. And I made a very intelligent decision, believe it or not. There was a new recording studio just starting up, World Broadcasting. And none of the big shots, the Truman Bradleys and Harlow Wilcox and Vinnie Pelletier and Tom Shirley, who were the creme de la creme of the announcers, they'd have nothing to do with it because there was no money involved. You couldn't blame them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I went over and auditioned for them. I sang a little, and I played a little, and I recited some poetry, and I did some narration and some announcing. They liked it. So I said, why don't I put myself to work for you for nothing? Mm-hmm. Now, you have prospective clients coming in, and I'm at your disposal if you think I could do it. I'm on call for any audition that you... And I knew I was bound to be heard by somebody, mm-hmm. whether I was hired or not. Mm-hmm. And the second week I did that, I got an offer from the Stomach Trouble Company. Stomach pills. What is the name of that stomach pill? Willard, yes, the Willard Messenger of Relief. That was it.
The Messenger of Relief.
The Willard Messenger of Relief. Pretty good, too. And so after a little dickering, which got me nowhere, I went to work at that. I was making more money than I had in Kansas City. And I went to work over at WLS, 7 o'clock in the morning, and did my little stint and went home. And then the next week they put me on over at the Wrigley.
BBM?
BBM. Mm-hmm. And that doubled my salary. And about another month following that, I was called to do the Air Adventures of Jimmy Allen, which was a great recorded show. It was a good show. Jimmy Allen lives out here now, Murray McLean. And they're wonderful people to work for. Not much money involved, but after all it paid, we did three of them a night, mm-hmm. and that counts up.
Three of them a night?
Yeah.
Would that be for the East Coast and the West Coast? And No, actually, they were recorded.
They were recorded.
Did it
so
that
they were
way,
recorded
I see.
Ahead. Yeah. And then another month went by, and I lucked into another for the Evans Fur Company, which I suppose is still going in Chicago.
Still involved in Chicago, yes.
And selling all these, as I said, on WCFL one Sunday morning after a bad Saturday night. You must come down and see these remarkable coats at these startling... startlingly low prices. That is one of my favorite fluffs. I made several in the course of time. And so that just about took up my time in so far as announcing shows uh-huh. were concerned. I did a lot of other things. I did a thing called Rocky the Shoemaker, a kid's show at BBM, and then this call started coming in for the cereals, and they started to run away with me, so I decided to drop the announcing
and just be an actor on the cereals,
huh? Yeah,
the daytime dramas.
Well, and
kid shows,
too. Well, yeah, There were a lot of night shows.
You were involved in them. You had the leading role in some of the daytime dramas, like Bachelor's Children and Midstream, wasn't that another one?
Bachelor's Children was a great one. We ran 11 years and had a wonderful cast. There was Olin Soleil and Pat Zeller.
Were you the bachelor?
Yes.
I got the next question here. I don't know whether I should ask it. Where did the children come from?
They were the daughters of an old army buddy of the doctor's, who was World War I vet, and the chap had saved his life during the war, that is Dr. Graham's life, and he found himself very badly off physically. He wrote to the doctor asking him to take care of his young daughters if something should happen to him, which it did.
It had to on one of
he died then. And the daughter showed up, the doctor and the dear old housekeeper, Ellen, expecting two small girls. Instead, they got twin beauties, young ladies. And Sam Ryder lived next door. That was Olin Soleil. And so then the fun began. It was a great series written by Bess Flynn, who died just a short time ago at the age of 93. She didn't conceive the idea of that until she was 52 years old. And did very well at it.
You were involved in the Guiding Light and the Right to Happiness.
Life, yes.
Was it the Road of Life and Woman in White? How many of those shows would you be doing in the prime there, back in Chicago, on an average week, for example? How busy would Hugh Studebaker be?
Well, despite Chickie, who says 45, I would say that 30 would be the
30 shows a
30
week.
30 shows a week.
That's quite a few
shows. As high as 35 frequently. Mm-hmm. But that was when I'd get trapped into a slide film or something like that. So you know what slide films are.
Yes, you would do a narration.
Poor devil if you do.
In those days when you had I've been told by the folks who used to get hung up on the slide films that you would be recording it on a wax disc, and if you would get through 11 of the 12 minutes on the slide film and you made a mistake or a flub, you'd have to start all over again.
Start all over, take it from the top.
Did you have
to
do
that? Yes, they were on these acetates, these large
discs.
Yes,
large
discs. I have some of them in there. Mm-hmm. And I remember once over at RCA, where we had 50-some takes.
50?
Yes, we started at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and we ended up approximately 3 o'clock the next morning. It was a highly technical thing of some sort, an engineering thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a bunch of actors shove technical terms at them with no dictionary available and no knowledgeable person to tell them how to pronounce things. And
well, how did you know you were wrong then?
Well, you didn't. We probably were a great deal of the time. Of course, the director was supposed to know, but he didn't always. But this particular night, it's a strange thing about fluffs. I don't know whether you've noticed it or not. The contagion of fluffs, its suggestion. And on slide films, it was particularly noticeable. One person would fluff. All right, take it from the top. Oh, my golly, I've got the second speech. On the second speech, you'd fluff. And so it would go. Each person would be God help the poor Dickens that had the last speech and the whole thing that had been going fine. But this one night I recall, I hope I'm not rattling off here too much.
Go right ahead.
But this one night, the Chaperie was not far from a famous nightclub, not far from RCA. Finally, the director threw up his hand and said, I want you all of you to get out of the studio, get out and sit down or take a walk. This was approximately 2 o'clock, 2:30 in the morning. Take a walk, talk about anything but this script. Now, I'll be back after a while. He came back after a while. He had a bottle of brandy, a bottle of scotch, and a bottle of bourbon. He opened them up. Now, there it is. Help yourselves. I trust you. Relax. Tell me when you're ready to go. It was never a more perfect recording on the first take.
Loosened you up enough to do it. Huh?
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. You were so much involved in Chicago in those days. Was it fun to be in Chicago then?
It was more fun than... I can't express the fun that it was. Of course, it was... I griped about it. Everybody griped about it. You griped about the weather. You griped about scripts. You griped about working too hard and felt very sorry for yourself. But we loved it. You know, there's one show that I never miss on Sunday night. Bob Newhart. The reason I mentioned Bob Newhart's show is because it gives me three lovely shots of the Wrigley Building.
That's right.
Which is my favorite building probably in the world.
You know, we used to love to hear the announcers from WBBM when they would say, this is the WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago.
Yeah.
And that was magic. That was really...
Well, it was magic to us. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Magic to us. And the greatest restaurant, of course, food in Chicago was out of this world. And to anybody with a healthy appetite and appreciation of good food, it was to be found in mm-hmm. Chicago, and particularly at the Wrigley Building. P.K. Wrigley demanded not only service but the greatest in quality. Mm-hmm. And we used to foregather there at Phil Wrigley's table after a large round table after the morning Bachelor's Children show, the afternoon when we put on it over in the Mart. But we'd have save our breakfast until after the mm-hmm. show and sit around the table. But just to show you how what sort of service they provided, being a country boy, I happen to like dandelion greens, wilted dandelion mm-hmm. greens. I don't suppose you ever heard of that.
Not as a main course.
No, I don't imagine so. Sounds a little noxious. Sounds like something for bilious trouble, but and probably was good for it. But I happened to mention to Mr. Shercliffe, the maitre d', manager of the restaurant, who at that time, during the Depression, P.K. was paying $50,000 a year.
He was paying $50,000 to the manager of the restaurant?
Yes. Which gives you an idea of the regard that he held for his customers.
It gives me an idea of going into the gum business.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's really been better than the baseball business recently. And the next morning, on my plate was a slab of ham and a huge mound of wilted dandelion greens with bacon and compliments of Mr. Shirtliff, who had wired or phoned down in Texas and had them flown in
during the night
so that I could have them for breakfast.
Wasn't that wonderful?
That was the sort of service that was provided by... And that's all. That concludes the commercial.
You played on Captain Midnight for a while.
Captain Midnight, I played for 6 years.
Weren't you Ichabod Mudd?
Ichabod Mudd, yes. Ichabod Mudd, the mechanic.
Did you do a lot of voices, a lot of different
dialects? I was never very good at voices. I was never very versatile. I mean, in the sense that a Bill Thompson was versatile, but I got by with it. We had a chance to do that on the revival of Vic and Sade, when they turned that into a longer show and put on extra characters.
They brought the characters to life then.
Yes.
They put people in the roles of the characters.
Yes, sometimes, unfortunately.
Yes.
And but it was fun, because we still had Vic. And, we still had Sade at that time. With the cab. Bernadine was still with us.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And Johnny Coons did Rush. I did Richigan, Fishigan from Sishigan, Michigan.
That was you, huh?
Yeah. And
lots of great characters visited that small house.
Yes, great characters. I did Mr. Henderson, which was a straight part, more or less.
That was on, was that on Vic and Sade, Mr. Henderson? You did
that
Mr. Henderson on Beulah.
Well, that was, I did.
A different Mr. Henderson.
That was, I did both of those.
When you were on the Beulah show, who was Beulah?
Hattie McDaniel. Well, and afterward...
Lillian Randolph?
Yeah, Lillian.
Amanda.
I always get that confused. We had a wonderful time on Beulah. I thoroughly enjoyed Beulah. That was a happy spot in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. That, of course, was out here.
Yes.
That you were on the Brewster Boy, or that Brewster Boy.
Yes,
that was
I
in
did
Chicago,
Mr. Brewster,
wasn't?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I dropped out of that.
There was a story about that show that has always been kind of interesting to me. It seemed that it was the Brewster Boy, and then they concluded it and called it Those Websters, and had many of the same people in it again.
Yeah, well, they moved it out here and renamed it to Those Websters.
Oh, they moved it here.
Yes.
That was the difference.
There was a bit of chicanery by the agency in depriving what I always considered the rightful owners of the show of their property. And I refused to go along.
Oh, I see. In other words, they were just changing the title and...
They were changing the title and taking the show. That's... Perhaps you'd like to cut that, I don't know.
No, that's part of the radio days. That's something that's... It's interesting.
But... I was fond at that time of the people who wrote the show and who had given me a very good chance as Mr. Brewster.
You left Chicago in the middle 40s to come out to the West Coast. Was it primarily because there was more work available out here then at that time than in Chicago?
Well, we were all rather bemused. We didn't know what to do. As it turned out, I wished I'd stayed in Chicago because I had... many, many offers still, even with the decline of radio. I could always go back to commercials, and I would probably have been happier had I stayed in Chicago. We had a lovely apartment up on Lake Shore, and Chick came out and bought a beautiful home out here. But it was a different world and one in which I was never quite as happy as I was in Chicago.
There are a lot of Chicagoans out here now and since then, too.
Oh, yes.
But never the same as being on... In front of the Wrigley Building on a windy day.
That's
walking
right.
Across the bridge and watching the skirts fly high.
That's right.
Huh? That's one of the good things about Chicago, too. One of the best things about Chicago was Hugh Studebaker. And one of the best things about our visit to California has been a chance to chat with you. And we appreciate your spending some time with us today.
Well, thank you so much, and welcome to our home, and so glad you came.
Thank you very much, Hugh.